This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab. Adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. As you know, before this time last week, the high priests of the political word were performing rites of extreme unction for the campaign of Joe Biden.
It is the drip, drip, drip that could become a drain for 2020 presidential hopeful named Joe Biden. He's not only slipping in the polls, he's also slipping in fundraising.
All the while, Joe Biden is struggling to hold on in some respects, show energy. There were a lot of hundreds of empty seats.
But then, suddenly, everything changed. Following poor results in the South Carolina primary, Pete Buttigieg dropped out, and Amy Klobuchar dropped out. And then, on Super Tuesday, resurrection.
10 primaries now on Super Tuesday that have gone to Joe Biden. You see a narrow margin. Biden getting Maine, getting Massachusetts, getting eight others. Sanders with Colorado.
Next thing you knew, Senator Elizabeth Warren and Mayor Mike Bloomberg had given up too, solidifying a showdown between Bernie Sanders and Joe Biden. And how? According to Rachel Bitticoffer of the Wasson Center for Public Policy at Christopher Newport University, the answer is that voters were mainly motivated not by health care or economic justice or college debt, but by perceived electability to send Donald Trump packing, which, she says, should come as no surprise because it is exactly what explains the historic Democratic blue wave in the 2018 midterm elections. Back then, when political mandarins were debating whether the party would come in just over or just under the 23-seat gain needed to control the House, Bitticoffer was all but alone in forecasting a 40-seat sweep. Afterwards, House Speaker-in-waiting Nancy Pelosi attributed it to America's insecurity about health care.
Health care was on the ballot, and health care won.
Nope, Bitticoffer says, it was about Trump. And a harbinger of massive Democratic turnout in November, which she explained to us as she raced to catch a flight.
What I am arguing is that the reason turnout in every election since Trump shot up 10 points is because of the agitation of the electorate, especially the Democratic and left-leaning independent portion of it, which was caught kind of sleeping in 2016 and had lower participation rates, now is suddenly very energized to vote.
This is a phenomenon known in political science circles as negative partisanship. What exactly does that mean?
Negative partisanship refers to the negative emotions people feel about the opposition party, distrust, anger, angst, even hatred. I am arguing that that is definitely what is driving them to the polls where they were not showing up before. Keep in mind that there's just a lot less what we call crossover voting now. About 10% of Republicans vote for Democrats and 10% of Democrats vote for Republicans in your average federal election. Polarization has really changed the way that people behave. You get these massive turnout swings.
I just want to ask you about your methodology. How is it different from pollsters who slice the electorate into a drillion different demographics and then further slice it district by district around the country, and the punditocracy that uses that to evaluate what's happening in the electorate?
All I'm doing is taking well-established findings from polling and political science research that says demographics predict partisanship, partisanship predicts voting. And then I'm using basically census data to say, here's where all the populations of latent Democratic-friendly electorate was. And I predicted that it was going to have a huge turnout surge that was going to make what looked like really friendly Republican territory turn into really friendly Democratic territory. Morning Joe panel sees that as, oh, it's a Republicans change their minds and are deserting the Republican Party. But actually what's going on in that is different voters being agitated to the polls.
The bottom line is that it's not the economy stupid. It's not the health care stupid. It's the stupid president stupid.
I mean, that's definitely right. In 2018, I expected Republicans to do what Democrats had done. Once they seized power, Democrats took their foot off the gas. So what I expected was, you know, to some extent, Republicans are going to be fat and happy now and they're going to relax. But instead, because Donald Trump does his negative partisanship and he artificially inflames it so well amongst Republican rank and file voters, that their turnout went up in the 2018 midterms, and that really helped them in the Senate map hold on to Texas, hold on to Georgia, hold on to Florida, where I thought those seats would probably flip. And they probably would have if Trump had not gone in and held rallies and told them, I'm on the ballot. This is a referendum on me, right? Which is, you know, the exact opposite advice any campaign consultant would ever give an incumbent midterm president, right?
Well, let's talk about campaign consultants, because in your New Republic piece recently, you said that Democratic consultants were telling the candidates in the midterm elections to stay away from Trump, to avoid the subject, that there was some risk in alienating independents and moderate Republicans by going personal.
When you look at the differentiation between the most timid of the Democrats and their strategies, what you'll notice is that the Republican turnout was the same number as other districts, and their own turnout, especially amongst Democratic partisans, lagged. So the data is just not supportive of this idea that there were disaffected Republicans joining hands with Democrats to flip these districts. The districts flipped because millennials in the suburbs who had not been voting, many who are 40 now, they're 40 and 30 years old, they had not been voting before, in midterms especially, and now they are.
I've been using the term conventional wisdom to describe what the anointed ones have told us is happening in the political landscape in your piece. You call that the Chuck Todd theory of politics. Tell me why.
I don't mean to pick on Chuck. I could fill in the blank with any mainstream analyst, Chris Matthews, James Carville. I wish that we lived in a world in which, you know, there's these big swaths of independents and they were super uber informed and they could be swayed just by, you know, being more pragmatic and bipartisan than the other guy. And that's what mattered to win a close election. But you just look pattern after pattern. A lot of them are not paying attention to politics at all. They're very emotive in their political attitudes. We sat through an impeachment trial in which the president was implicated day after day, just in the absolutely jaw-dropping amounts of evidence, and public opinion was completely inelastic to it, right? So we're clearly living in a time period that is different than that conventional wisdom.
The Chuck Todds of the world had buried Joe Biden because he performed badly in the Iowa caucuses. He performed badly in New Hampshire and was becoming kind of a punchline. And yet he crushed Bernie Sanders and especially the other hopefuls. In your world, this has nothing to do with Joe Biden, the candidate. It has to do with the phenomenon you're describing of just absolutely transcendent revulsion.
Yes. To be fair to the Chuck Todds of the world, I too looked at Biden. He looked dead in the water. He had no money. What it came down to is that when the nomination started to really look like it was going to go to Sanders, the idea of nominating somebody who has got the label of a socialist, I think there is this deep-seated fear that if the party nominated Sanders, they would lose not only the presidency, but their opportunity to hold on to Congress and to the Senate. The candidate doesn't matter much in 2020. You want to have diversity on the ticket. So since Joe Biden happens to be a moderate white male, you want to have ideological diversity, so someone who's more liberal, and racial and gender diversity, so someone who's a female person of color, to balance out representation. But we are going to see turnout go up amongst young people if it's Biden or if it's Sanders, because people are responding to the threat of Donald Trump.
Now, if one were in support of Joe Biden as the candidate, probably one would be constantly on edge that he would do something or say something just positively catastrophic. But if this cycle is indeed the ultimate expression of negative partisanship, what we learned from Trump is that there is nothing he can do or say that is going to change the overarching dynamics of the race because nobody's going to vote against him.
That's exactly right. Because Sanders or Biden, there's no liability either of those men possess that Trump doesn't have 1,000% more of. The problem is the Democratic Party is inept at messaging and campaigning. So that's where the weakness between nominating someone like Biden versus Sanders comes in.
If you're right, then Joe Biden could shoot somebody in the middle of Orange Street in Wilmington, Delaware.
Well, to a degree. At the end of the day, Donald Trump's going to pull in somewhere around 47, 48% of the two-party vote in these swing states. And the only question is it going to be enough like it was in 2016? Because the Republican Party is successful in getting the not-Trump coalition to fracture and waste votes on third-party candidates? Or is it going to fall short because the vote winner in 2020 needs to crack 50%?
There's something about your theory of the awakening of the formerly complacent Democrat that doesn't make sense. We've been hearing in the ongoing media narrative about the 20 million millennials who have never before voted and finally have their opportunity to cast their ballots in a way that can express their well-established desire for social and economic justice. And the candidate, Bernie Sanders, who has most made them an issue. But they didn't turn out. They didn't show up on Super Tuesday.
We actually see a turnout surge amongst all voting groups right now. So even though youth voting is up right now, it's up amongst all groups. So it's not proportionally showing an increase. All right. So if there was a youth turnout surge, it would be because of Donald Trump and not because of Sanders.
One of the seeds of conventional wisdom that sprouted in the last few days was that the results are a reflection of educated Republican women in the suburbs having had enough of Trump.
It's anecdotally true, but in terms of the overarching data story, it's about different turnout of millennials and independents who are left-leaning and Democrats turning those districts into demographically favorable districts for Democrats, not because Republicans had kumbaya moment. Republicans are actually stoked on Donald Trump. They love what he's doing.
Rachel, thank you very much. Run for your plane.
Yeah, I'm trying. Bye.
Rachel Bitticoffer is the Assistant Director of the Wasson Center for Public Policy at Christopher Newport University.
Coming up, how much it'll cost you to use phrases like women's health and women's rights at the UN, because Mr. Moneybags is the American president.
This is On the Media.